Welcome to What You Know About RJ, sharing stories and skills about restorative justice, a podcast of the California Conference for Equality and Justice. I'm still your host, Gilbert Salazad, and we're continuing our conversations around culture, relationships, and justice in schools. And I feel many sweet memories before I pass the mic to our next guest, because this next guest sent me a poetry podcast recommendation in the middle of that crazy spring semester that was last school year. So I'm going to pass the mic to our next guest for his introduction.
Thank you so much, Gilbert. My name is Tobin Pop, and I work for Green Dot Public Schools on the ed team. I manage a lot of different pieces in our programs, including our advisory program, our school culture, and I've recently taken a role at our expanded learning program as well, which oversees after-school athletics and internships. I've been working with youth in South LA for the last 21 years. I was a high school teacher for 8 of those, and then have bounced around and done some nonprofit work with the after-school sector, with summer camps. And I was chasing you for a while, Gilbert, because you were, you had an amazing presence at Markham Middle School, and I took over a summer camp program there the year after you had left. And I heard so much about Gilbert and how Gilbert trained us. And then, and then the stars aligned, and I've been really blessed to work with you in CCJ for the last 3 years.
I was thinking about podcasts and camp counselors, because you were a camp counselor for a long time, no?
I was, yeah.
And I was a camp counselor before I was ever a camper, because when I was in AmeriCorps, the National Civilian Community Corps, last 2 month project was as a camp counselor in YMCA, in a YMCA camp. And it was at this camp that I did what now we call Circle. And so had it not been for that experience, I would not have been as grounded as I think I am, particularly at Markham, because super quickly, so our camp was in McLennanville, and so young students from North Charleston would be taken to McLennanville, which is like an hour away from Charleston, and North Charleston is very historically Black, and the students that were taken to this camp or brought to this camp had never been to a camp or the forest before. And in a very non-restorative way, the camp director told the story of Lizard Man. And if you leave your cabin at night, the Lizard Man will come and get you. And so, and for a lot of these students, their first time away, first time in the forest at night, the first few nights, they didn't want to go to bed. They were like, talking, they were being, what could be labeled disruptive or defiant. And so, and I really wanted sleep, after a whole day of teaching various programs, and then, you don't stop working until you're asleep. And even then you're still working if something happens. And then I think all I could do one day was have them sit on the ground with their pillows. And I think I asked them some questions or some story, and it got us all very calm. And then in that moment of what I now know is vulnerability, I asked them, tell me why we don't want to go to sleep. And then what came up, and these are all like young boys, young men from North Charleston being and doing what they have to be to survive. And they were like, we're afraid of Lizard Men. And so every night I would have this space and we would talk about the day. And so for me, that's my favorite memory as a camp counselor. What's a memory that you have that you connect with when you were a camp counselor?
Wow, that's really powerful. Thank you for sharing. And it's hard to drill down to just one moment. So the summer camp at Markham that you helped start, you were there the very first year. I was the camp director there the second and third years of the program, and just really, really proud of the work that happened there. And we, as a team, we decided, you know, we set our goals really high and said, we're going to, you know, our goal for this camp is to make it the best summer camp in LA, period. Right. And no asterisks for considering it's in Watts or considering the population we serve or considering it's free. No, we're going to make it the best summer camp in LA. And we could do that because we had relationships and because we had the right people on the team and because we had creativity. And there's like these elements of theater of the oppressed, right? What do you dig into when you don't have resources, right? And you make magic happen. I think we found the right balance too of getting everyone on the same page, but then allowing staff to really teach and run activities that they were passionate about, right? And let kids choose too, right? Part of it is letting kids know what's out there, and then the other part is letting kids choose what they explore. And maybe it was gardening. We had an amazing gardening program at that garden at Markham, and part of it was coding, and part of it was just like straight up sports and arts and crafts. And I was just really, really proud of the team and the product that we put out there, So I don't know. I mean, maybe if I have to pick one moment, maybe it was our culminating day. We had a carnival, and each group puts on a little booth, and they're all, you know, games off the kids' heads. You know, it's all just like super creative and fun and silly. And then we invited parents, and the parent turnout, maybe we had 125 campers, let's say, and the parent turnout was unbelievable, to the point where the principal of Markham at that time came out and said, how are you getting this level of parent engagement, right? This is something we're struggling at a 1,200 kid middle school or whatever. We're not seeing this many parents on parents' night, and you have parents showing up with plates of homemade food and with the whole family in tow to celebrate this program that has meant so much to their students and their kids and the community. And that was something that our staff was really, really proud of, and felt like real validation for the work we put in over the summer. So
we have a shared Markham connection, and obviously connection in this work. And I'm super curious of what, if anything, what you could share about how RJ has impacted you.
Yeah, I've learned so much about RJ. Green that we talked about is restorative practices. That's probably what's going to come out of my mouth. I just wanted to preface that. And I think, you know, as I've continued to learn, I've learned so much. I still have so much more to learn. It's been both, you know, comforting and challenging, right? Comforting because partly I already know this, right? Part of it's like, oh, as I learn stuff, it's like, oh, right, I know that on some human level, right, this is the right way to treat people. And so I think that you know, articulates something that was already just knowledge that I had. And then it's also super challenging because it's hard. It's really, really hard, and it takes a lot of time. And so kind of, I toggle between those two, that comfort and that challenge, but continue to be just impressed by how widely applicable it is, right? So we did this training with some of our admin a few years ago on affective statements, right? And then that was 1 month, and a couple months later, we came back and said, you know, how's this going? And one of our amazing APs said, you know where this has been the most helpful? At home. Is I use this with my kids now, right? This is how I talk to my daughter and my son and my wife, and it has transformed our household. And I was like, oh wow, right, of course. This does, you know, this isn't specific to school campuses. And so so that's been exciting too, and I think it's just shifted my mindset and given me new tools to be a better human all throughout the day. So
a better human all throughout the day. Yes. Yes. And which is a lot of time and energy and effort and discomfort. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the other, you know, I think the other piece that has been interesting I've learned is that, RJ and restorative practices, incorporates, so much of what's already going on in the best schools, in the best classrooms. And I think sometimes, you know, if we come to, let's say we come to a veteran teacher and say, you know, we have this new focus on RP and, you know, they've been in this long enough to say, oh, another new focus, right? When is this going to go away? And what do I have to do differently? And those teachers, and we have such amazing teachers in Green Dot who are running these amazing relationship-based classrooms. They might not be calling it restorative practice, but they are creating restorative spaces. And an analogy we've used in our trainings is with Fitbit. So 20 years ago, you know, nobody was talking about how many steps they've taken, right? Like that just wasn't part of the vocabulary. But people were walking. People understood the value of walking. They knew they needed to stay active, right? But something about Fitbit gave us a shared language and allowed us to push each other and monitor each other. And so I think there's some parallels with restorative practice where it's like, we're not reinventing the classroom, right? If you already have a relationship-based classroom that includes student choice and voice, where you honor everybody's identity, you have a culturally responsive curriculum, like you're ticking a lot of the boxes already, but by focusing on restorative practices, it allows us to push that practice forward because it gives us this shared language and this new framework. And so part of it's just, again, I've been a teacher for 8 years. I was so wary of new stuff coming down the pipeline. And so just trying to be conscious of the audience and saying, if you're doing great work, you're going to continue to do that great work. And we're going to help you share that great work. And we're going to push you to do even greater work.
I love that. I've never heard that. And again, it's the power of your creative brain and the creative brains at Green Dot, who I've admired for a number of years in our partnership. So the other question, I think in order to shape a metaphor such as Fitbit, there's a level of understanding and flexibility about what am I bringing to this work? What have you brought into the work of restorative practice, brought into its implementation, its training, and in your relationships with colleagues?
I've tried to bring the creativity that you mentioned. The Fitbit analogy, actually, I came up with for my interview for Green Dot because I was, you know, I was teaching like a sample lesson and you know, this is 3 years ago. I was just kind of processing and trying to make connections and I'm a big fan of analogy and metaphor and story and so it's, you know, as just in my general day to day, I'll be keeping an eye out for connections that we can make, right? And that I could bring back to people because, you know, everyone learns in different ways and everyone processes things in different ways. And I think the more angles we can come at it, again, a simple example, I was, you know, saw somewhere online, a little blurb, I think it was on Reddit on Today I Learned that thinking back to World War II, that Kyoto had been the original target for the atomic bombs that's where the US was going to bomb. And that was like done. That was set. That was like ready to move forward until the Secretary of War at the time, Henry Stimson, I think, he stepped in and put a hard stop to it and fought really hard to pick other cities to redirect to Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And it came out later that he had honeymooned in Kyoto, that he had visited Kyoto many times, that he had relationships in that city. And so when I thought of this, I thought, this is why people are accountable to relationships they value, right? Again, putting myself in his shoes and making some speculation here that his relationship with that city, because there was no kind of stated reason why, right? These were military. Kyoto was a great military target, but it was shifted because of his relationship with the city. And so, anyway, so taking that little blurb and trying to think how can we leverage that to help people understand restorative practices and restorative beliefs and get everyone to invest in those relationships because we know how beautiful classrooms and schools and communities can be when those relationships are strong and everybody's accountable and no one wants to do harm to each other.
I really just want to pause here around creativity because I think where I felt the most empowered in this work has been when there's been a challenge, let's say like a Markham, I'm in the middle of a facilitation and I feel like I'm drowning because I'm trying to figure out how do I present this structure of communication to adults and students or families who have not had this experience in this structure before. And so for me, my leaning into was games and my background in like theater and education. So I leaning into that creativity, you know, years later brought a whole training and structure and around games. And so I always remind folks when I do coaching around the power of pausing and intuition and creativity, because that's where the work can really show up in different ways. What are some ways in which different schools and admin folks have been used their own creativity in this work?
We still use your games a lot. We love your Circle Handbook, and I can't wait to get it. I know there's a second iteration of that, and can't wait to get trained on Circle Games 2.0. And so that's a great entry point. You know, there's been some interesting leveraging of technology to help. One of our schools has gone. Our middle schools is using a program called Live School, which replace their merit demerit tracker. None of our schools use merit demerits anymore, right? It's all just merits now. But the precision that you can get with this tool has allowed them to make some really interesting restorative choices. So something like a bathroom policy, right? Which can feel people can have really strong feelings about. I have strong feelings about bathroom policy. I have strong feelings about giving a kid 3 coupons and saying you go to the bathroom 3 times this semester. You know, whatever it is. And I think we see schools moving away from that, which is wonderful. But they have just a system. So a student can use the restroom anytime they want at that school. And the teacher just logs when they're using the restroom, when they leave, and when they come back. Right. And so it's all just tracked. And there's grace within that, but it allows them to see patterns and have conversations, curiosity. Right. I see across the school day. Right, you're using the bathroom in every single class, right? Or you know, for every day, for every you know. And what are the patterns here? What's going on? Is there anything we can support you with? Mm-hmm. It just allows for more meaningful conversations, as well as it collects so many data points that it's fascinating. So they had a parent come in and say, you know, I feel like my student's not doing well, and this and that, and they were able to pull this up and look at literally thousands of data points for the semester where that student had gotten recognition in the class. Because it's as simple as a click, right? The student gets it, this student, the whole class gets it, this and that, versus anytime there was, anytime there needed to be a correction. Mm-hmm. And just looking at that data really shifted the parents' understanding of what was going on. And sometimes kids don't even have a clear understanding, right? They see themselves in one way, but the data showing something different, how often they are actually celebrated. And I think it can also flag where there's relationship problems. I, as a teacher, I valued my relationship with students. I saw how important that was, but I had 140 students and I'm not going to have that relationship with every student. And so it starts to help see trends about what might be going on with Tobin and this student, because this student's not getting corrections in any other classes. And is this a space for where we can have some conversation around that? So that has been a really interesting, just all the avenues that it's opened up and allowed them to be a lot more restorative with their approach.
Tobin, you had mentioned one of our restorative beliefs earlier. What does one of our beliefs is no one is disposable. What has that meant for you? How have you shaped that as understanding? And then what are some ways in which the restorative beliefs that TCJ has for this work that they've been put into practice to any of the structures on the Green Dot?
So I love them. I love them all. And we'll get to that. And I love no one is disposable. And it that one landed to me at an interesting time. Mm-hmm. And got me thinking about the kind of disposability in American culture and convenience culture in general. And I just thought this, nobody is disposable. It just landed as so refreshing to me and sort of radical as well. And what it got me actually thinking about was paper towels. And the reason why, I mean, paper towels is this incredibly disposable commodity, right? And so at our home office, we were doing a big shift to say, we're getting rid of all paper products in the staff lounge, right? And so coffee cups, for me, super easy, right? No more paper coffee cups. Great. I'm going to bring one from home. I got it. I got multiple coffee cups. Then the next stage was asking us to bring forks and knives and plates, right? And just clean them after you eat. We're getting rid of all paper plates and plastic knives. All right, that felt like a little more of a stretch, but I can do that, right? I have an extra fork and an extra plate. And then the next ask was saying, we're getting rid of all paper towels, right? And so they asked people to bring in a napkin. And this was so hard for me to get my head around, Gilbert. I was like, I rely so heavily on paper towels, right? And it felt like a really sticking point. I was like, where do I even get a napkin? What do I do with that napkin after it's dirty, right? I just want to wipe this problem up and throw it away. I don't know if you have any idea of how many paper towels Americans use, but it's like crazy. This is like a very American thing. I went looking for more information about it. So globally, paper towels are a $12 billion industry, and Americans buy $5.7 billion of that. But it got me thinking about how we see so much stuff as disposable, how heartbroken I am when I go to a thrift store and all I see is IKEA stuff that's like falling apart, right? Because people will just buy it cheap and then I can replace it. And it got me further to thinking about some of my lowest moments as a classroom teacher, where I wanted the convenience of a kid being out of my classroom because it felt too messy, right? And this feels too hard for me right now. And I don't feel like I have the time to circle back, to address this, to clean up this mess that I helped make, or maybe I made myself. And so it's, calling security, calling admin, can you get this kid out of my room? And it's that paper towel mentality, right? That somehow the student is disposable because that's easier for me, because it's more convenient. And so I think this idea of disposability is tied up with convenience. We see it in the criminal justice system. Zero tolerance is convenient. Three strikes is convenient, right? Because we don't have to know your story. We don't have to know the circumstances. We don't have to know what needs of yours aren't being met. This is what happens, right? And so anyway, so we rely heavily on this belief at Green Dot, and we tie it often to our discipline data, and have people look at that. And, as with national trends, there's still some disparity in our discipline data about who gets suspended more often than who. And as an organization, we believe that no one is disposable, but our numbers don't always show that. And so that pushes us and holds us accountable to do better by students.
And Tobin, these asks that staff were asked, the mug to the utensil to the napkin, were those all scaffolded, and how long in between were those asks made?
No, they were totally scaffolded. I'm trying to remember what the role, it wasn't super long, a couple weeks between each one. And it was really fun. It was community building. They had like this mugshot wall where you held up your mug and put it up, and to celebrate everyone who's doing it. And you felt the shift. But for myself and for a lot of other people, that no paper towels thing was really hard.
Mm. That makes you think about Mario Martinez and the Mind and Body Code, and he cites a researcher who created this concept called paradigm rupture, or stages of paradigm rupture. And so the stages are anger, denial, and then acceptance, in terms of like a new, when someone is introduced to a new paradigm. And so, which makes me think often about historically years ago, presenting this work for the first time in schools and teachers, and around this denial of the data, or denial of, I don't need to learn how to do this. And then the shift around acceptance. And so I always think of those stages when I see things like people saying, I don't want to wear a mask, or I don't need to worry about this. And so, in terms of anger and denial. So I was very curious about the scaffolded stages around these requests.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't see anger. I didn't see it. I might have felt a little frustration for sure. But yeah, I think on some level that, yeah, that did play out. I like that. I like that paradigm a lot. And there continues to be some level of that as we move forward with the sort of practice. And I think that, again, just in it being unfamiliar, right? And again, sometimes landing is feeling like this is something else. I'm already so busy. Teachers are so busy, right? And feeling like something else. And I think that's been part of the magic of the beliefs, is that they're so accessible, and they're specific enough to be meaningful, but also general enough for people to bring their own stories to it and say, oh, right, man, nobody is disposable. I can think of somebody who may feel disposable. I can think of a group that may be disposable, and it may be different than your group, but I get that. Everyone needs to be seen, heard, and understood, right? Yes, of course. Yes, I agree. And so that's actually been, it's complemented our data. We're a data-driven organization, and we look at a lot of data. And again, people have different feelings about data, and sometimes there can be just data fatigue. We talk about the six circle model, which is something we learned from National Equity Project when we partnered with them, and this idea that above the green line, there's this technical piece that you need in an organization, and maybe data lives up there, but below the green line, there's this relational piece that's also super important that fills out the story. And so recently, when we've been sharing data, we've been sharing maybe suspension data, again, next to people need to be next to no one is disposable, or sharing data from California Healthy Kids Survey about whether kids feel safe at school. And then next to the belief that safety is created through clear expectations, mm-hmm. right? And so saying, how do these inform each other? And, but people have really embraced them, which is, it's just so exciting. We ran a professional development, and my colleague Tim and I, and we had the posters up, which are beautiful. The artwork itself is just so inviting, and it invites you into to love these beliefs. And we had them up, and so we start the presentation, and at some point, early on, we're like, hey, are there any questions? And so many hands shot up, and took the first question, and it was a principal saying, where do I get those posters, right? And I said, okay, we'll talk about that. Are there any other questions? All the hands went down, right? All people just wanted to know about how they get these beautiful posters onto their campuses to share with their staff and students. And so we were able to gift a set of the posters to every campus. Which is from some grant money that we had that was a grant that was found by friend and colleague Patty Wu, and so part of her amazing legacy. And then they've also, we see them embedded in our professional development decks. We see them embedded in student-facing advisory decks. Students are just starting to see them now. The rollout was for this school year. But they're accessible to students too, right? And I think they're really empowering to students. And again, just gives us shared language, almost like our norms. I'm trying to think when, maybe my fourth or fifth year of teaching, I really wanted to embrace emotional intelligence in my classroom. And this is 2005, and I didn't really know exactly what I was doing. But I happened to have done a study abroad program with Hanuman Goleman, whose dad is Daniel Goleman, who wrote EQ. And Hanuman is like the most beautiful human being. Just radiates love, and again, I can only, when I see him and I think about him as sort of this poster child for EQ, right? And and he's actually the human that I call to mind when I want to center myself, and just like, how do I channel Hanuman's energy and smile? And so I was going off that book EQ, which I loved, and then I had a friend who was doing some work with harm and conflict and peer mediation up in the Bay Area. And he turned me on to this song by Red Grammar called See Me Beautiful. And it's sort of this like hokey folk song. And I would play it for my students. And, you know, they get kind of, and I would sing along and just play it up. But it's like, see me beautiful, look for the best in me, and on and on. But then I had them write on a piece of paper that was going to be in the front of the notebook, see me beautiful. And it became a catchphrase in our classroom when someone was, you know, throwing shade at someone or just wasn't quite treating them right. To diffuse the situation, it could be, hey, see me beautiful, right? Mm. See the best in me. And to me too, right? Hey, Pop, see me beautiful, right? Why are you coming at me like that right now? And so I think there's real value in just the shared language. And so I'm excited to see how the shared language of your 17 restorative beliefs grow within Green Dot.
The topics that I've been holding space for with folks in this season and series of the podcast has been around RJ and culture, relationships, and justice. A question that I've been asking folks, particularly the white allies and the white colleagues that I've been in space with there, or what your journey has been as a white person in this work, like what have you learned and what do you want to call in for other white folks who are in education?
Yeah, I think, you know, one image from podcast Nice White Parents that stuck out with me is they made an analogy about white people being like a guy with a big backpack in a small store. You know, maybe the backpack is privileged and just without even being aware of it is knocking things over and doing damage. And maybe even if you go down to pick up something you knock down, you end up knocking down more. And so I've been thinking a lot about what my impact has been. Again, I've been working in South LA for the better part of 21 years, and I don't know, you know, that I have the complete perspective on what my impact has been, because I recognize there's blind spots, and over the last few months I've recognized more and more blind spots. I started working at Locke High School, which is in Watts, in 1999. And I came with a general sense of privilege, of what my privileges had been. There's this wonderful phrase that I go back to. I was born on third, but thought I hit a triple. Mm. And I just hadn't understood how many things had fallen into place for me to set me up to this success. In high school and college and work. And I I'm still trying to figure all of that out and unpack it, because it's really, really complicated, all of the privilege. And, so I had a general sense of being born on third. And as I look back now, I guess I do think I had a net positive impact on the amazing students that I worked with. But I know I could have done more, and my regrets aren't, all these things that I did to students that I shouldn't have done to students, but it's just this wish that I had been able to do more and that I had the language to do more. I, after the murder of George Floyd, I had the opportunity to reach out to some Black friends and Black colleagues and just kind of let them know where my head was at. And I shared with them a poem that has guided my work. I did a lot of poetry in college and came across this poem, this very short poem by Robert Creeley early on. It's called A Fragment. And it goes like this. On the streets, I am met with constant hostility, and I would finally have nothing else around me except my children, who were trained to love and whom I intend to leave as relics of my intentions. And I kept this poem in my pocket and said, all right, this is guiding me. I'm gonna train these students to love. This is my goal. I'm gonna build relationships and show them love and allow them to express love. And that guided me for a long time. And part of what I messaged to my Black friends and colleagues is that I need to do more. I need to be more active. That feels like just too passive a space to be in. And so I'm really interested in this idea of of a white shield. And if you're familiar with this, but in some of the protests that have happened across the country, some of the Black Lives Matter protests, protesters have called in a white shield, which means that white people go and stand in the front lines because they are treated better by police, right? And thinking about how do we extend that from a literal white shield protecting protesters from police brutality to being a figurative white shield, and where opportunities for me to stand up and leverage my privilege and leverage my voice and support everyone in the communities. And so so that's been something that I've been thinking about and just am recommitted to the work and rethinking about kind of what service looks like and what my role is. And I think, you know, you also asked what I might message to other white educators. And first of all, you know, before you listen to me, talk to the people around you, especially your students, your colleagues of color, the community, this is where choose curiosity over assumptions comes in, I think. Mm-hmm. And don't assume what your role is going to be. And don't assume that I can tell you what your role is going to be because I don't know the specifics of it. So I'll try and stick to just sharing my general story. And part of what I think about is an experience I had 4.5 years ago when the Dakota Access Pipeline protests were going on up in North Dakota and up at Standing Rock. And I had an opportunity to go up. Friends of mine were going. They needed another driver to make a supply run. And so we did the drive pretty much straight, 34-ish hours, just rotating drivers and getting up there. This was in early December. And one of the first things they ask you to do when you get to camp is they ask everybody who's new to camp to go to an orientation session in this big, this kind of the big hall, the big, the common space. And is led by a couple of Indigenous women, and they welcomed everybody wholeheartedly and appreciate everybody coming because we help amplify everyone there helped amplify the voice of this and appreciated the support. Then went on to say that that the protest is Indigenous led, and that they are not looking for advice from anybody, outside advice, especially from white men. So if you're a white man, you're welcome here, but keep your ideas to yourself. And it was framed very, very nicely, but wasn't something I'd ever heard articulated before. And sort of, you know, turns the cultural hierarchy on its head in some ways, right? In The Simpsons, Homer has this quote where people are lamenting, like his dad saying, "I'm too old, no one listens to me," and Lisa saying, "I'm too young and I'm a girl, no one listens to me," and he says, I'm a white male, age 18 to 49. Everyone listens to me, no matter how stupid my ideas." Mm. And there's some truth in that. And so I'm up there at Sandy Rock. I just left my job as an executive director of a foundation and was doing fundraising and board meetings and organizations and saying, can't I bring anything else here to support? And the answer was no. And so I was only there for 4 days, and I spent 4 days carrying water and chopping wood, right? Because that's what needed to be done. And I spent a lot of time doing dishes because that's what needed to be done. So I think sometimes white educators need to just execute and not need to innovate on everything. One of the ways we talk about equity in Green Dot is that equity is giving all students a rigorous curriculum, right? We can't have this situation where kids are taking 12 years of education to get taking 12 years of their life to get 6 years of education, right? This is creating major, major issues. And that's the way things have been. And so how do we counteract this? By having rigorous, culturally responsive curriculum that we're sticking to and we're pushing our students' education forward. That's how we start to close some of these gaps. And as a white teacher, as a white educator, if you feel like the curriculum's not culturally responsive, you can surface that, but I don't even know that your voice is needed in the conversation to fix that. Your voice isn't the primary voice, I would say. And so if you lead with curiosity, execute on what you can control, execute in service of your students and of your community, even if it's not exactly how you saw your role. I think that gets us a little bit closer. And I also want to say that, look, we need great teachers, right? No matter what identities they bring. So welcome everybody who's going to be a great teacher and committed to this work. Like, we need all great teachers. And one of the things we learned from our CCJ identity walk is all the different identities, gender, race. Some of those things are more obvious, right? And we can talk about them a little bit more, but all the other things that we bring to work, that we bring to this life, whether it's our family relationships or our health or our religion, these are also all points, possible points of connection for students, right? I think of like the ideal school, and I think there's something limiting if every teacher at that school shares the same identities with every student at that school. I think there's something limiting about that. Just as there's something limiting if no teachers at that school share identities with students. And so I think there's a strategic mix that can come in where people's different identities can really benefit students. And I think about when I was teaching in Inglewood, Animo Inglewood, and I had a student who she identified as Latina back, you know, 10 years ago now. And she missed a lot of school, and her friends came to me and they said, as they knew I had a good relationship with her, and said, hey, Pop, can you help her out? She's really struggling with depression and she just doesn't know who to turn to. And I was able to call on part of my identity, which is someone who's struggled with mental health, to make a connection. So I talked to the counselor, said, hey, can I make first point of contact with this student? Because I know this student and I have a story to tell. And so I was able to reach out to that student, share the story about my mental health struggles, and make a connection on a different part of our identity, right? Around health, around mental health. Though even in that, it's different, right? Because I think about, again, being born on third and being born to parents with amazing health care and all the opportunities that I had when I was struggling with my mental health in high school and all the resources that I had. So, you know, it's the same in one way and also not the same. I guess, you know, lastly, I guess I do have a lot to say to white colleagues, but it's stuff maybe I wish I had heard. And just being, I think this curiosity runs throughout it all. And I think it's being curious about easy ways to incorporate culturally responsive teaching in your classroom. And maybe you're not in charge of the curriculum. But, you know, if you look at like Zaretta Hammond's book, Culturally Responsive Teaching in the Brain, it talks about just basic buckets here about how some cultures learn more independently and some cultures learn more in like a group style. Some cultures learn more like kind of written work and some are more oral traditions. And so how are you incorporating all those pieces into your classroom to value everybody's experiences? Or some of the amazing work by Dr. Holly, who talks about, you know, culturally responsive teaching and situational appropriateness, right? How do you teach a student? You know, a student comes into your classroom, you know, dribbling a basketball or singing or louder than you think they should be. How do you respond? Do you respond by calling security and saying, get out of here, or sending them back out until they can come back in better? Or do you embrace it and acknowledge that there is nothing wrong with dribbling a basketball? There is nothing wrong with singing. There's nothing wrong with raising your voice, right? I'm going to meet you on the blacktop at lunch and I'm going to beat your butt in one-on-one. And if you want to sing together, stay after class, and, you know, on and on and on. And I'm going to celebrate what you're bringing to me and not devalue any part of you, while also saying now is not the right time because we need to get to work. But if I've set my classroom up right and you're a student who loves to talk and be loud, then you just wait for 45 minutes from now. We're going to do a group activity and you can be the one who shares out and talk about what your group talked about, right? Mm-hmm. And so how do you push your practice to just make it feel really, as accessible to all students, all cultures, all experiences?
As I listen to you speak, and as I've known you for, you know, the few years that I've known you, and I think about these questions that we've laid out earlier about how has RJ impacted you? What have you brought? How have you, you know, and I think about how you have contributed to shaping the work at Green Dot around this work as well. And so I think that there's been a lot of themes that have come up in these interviews. The first one is a lot around vulnerability, and folks have named vulnerability as a factor needed in this work for its most impact. Folks have named RJ as a lifestyle. RJ it's not just a thing you do. And I think with you, one thing that comes up for me as a characteristic or a value that's needed in this work, for this work to be expansive, is I can't think of the word, but I could just think of there's a phrase around fueling fire. And fire is an element that I've been working on in my own personhood lately, particularly as I watch Avatar, The Last Airbender. And so I think about, how do you fuel your own fire, whatever fire means to you? Like, how do you continue to show up in this work of relationships and culture and justice? Because it asked for a lot. It sounds like it asked for chopping wood and bringing in water and washing dishes. That's what was required. That's what was asked. How do you fuel your fire?
That's a great question. And yeah, it does. It requires a lot of, work requires a lot of energy. I think about something about the question, this idea of chopping wood. There's an old adage that, chopping wood warms you three times, right? When you chop it, when you stack it, and then when you burn the wood. Mm-hmm. I think the work itself, in some ways, although it feels draining at times, it continues to warm me at all of those levels. And I've often thought about this as especially as a new teacher who's working a lot. Even in my eighth year of teaching, I was still at school almost every Saturday, just setting things up and getting ready for the week. And that's not uncommon, right? Teachers work really, really long hours. But what I've also found to be true, and it wore me down at times, but this work always gives more than it takes. It just always does. And so I think that even when I'm feeling depleted, try and keep my perspective that this is, sort of the temporary state, and what I'm going to be left with is something that I can carry with me and can continue to fuel me. So it's that it can be, sort of perpetual motion. Have we discovered perpetual motion here with the work? And then the relationships fuel me too. I still am lucky enough to be in touch with some students who graduated class of 2001 at Locke High School, right? Who are now almost 40 years old. And last year at Green Dot, I had 9 former students as full-time Green Dot employees. And those are teachers and counselors. And that warms me right now, just thinking about that and thinking about even how much better positioned they are to make an impact. And seeing, right, that, whatever impact I had amplified. And so that's, again, going back to that poem, which still means a lot to me, even if it's insufficient, right, that I trained my kids, my students to love, and they're relics of my intentions, and they will carry the work in their own way, their own footsteps. They're gonna not seek to follow my footsteps, but to seek what I sought, I think, which is justice and equity and opportunity. And so that's really, that continues to fuel me as well.
Any final questions or curiosities or shout outs or calling in around this work?
I think one of my lingering curiosities is about kind of closing the gap that I sometimes see with some educators in terms of their role and their personal responsibility within dysfunctional systems. I think about this with the school to prison pipeline, and where if you denounce the prison system, in this country, which should be denounced. If you denounce it, then it's incompatible as an educator to engage in exclusionary discipline, to send kids out of the room, to send kids to the office, to advocate for kids to be suspended or expelled. Because we know, right, we have such good data on this, that that leads to the criminal justice system, right? It's the school to prison pipeline, and the school is the start of that. And we still see people who, I still see very liberal educators who will tell you how screwed up our criminal justice system is, and miss their role in it. And I think it with, you know, even more current with the calls to defund the police, right? And the idea that some of those resources are spent in actually to meet people's needs, to meet communities' needs. And if you believe in defunding the police and reallocating some of these resources and letting police do the police work, but other mental health professionals and other people come in and support, then again, that's incompatible with calling security every time there's a minor incident in your classroom and saying, get kids out of here, right? Because we're not meeting our students' needs. And so I think that people taking ownership and looking at the bigger picture and thinking about how their actions and fit into the bigger things. Because it's easy to talk about how screwed up the prison system is and how someone else should go and change that. Someone else out there, and instead of thinking my small, you know, what is my small role in it? And so I'm continuing, you know, continuously curious about that. How do we push people's thinking on that? And also having been a teacher that has asked for students to be removed from my room, right? Having been felt like I've been pushed to that point, which is not, again, my proudest moments of teaching, but I'm there and I wish I had better tools and I wish I had a better understanding myself, because again, I was one of them who missed that connection sometimes. So
I feel very fueled from our time together, and in the next season will be what I hope will be some looking at some larger questions about RJ. Feel even more fueled from your story as a volunteer at Standing Rock, but I'm reading the last essay of the Living Justice Press's latest book, which is Colorizing RJ. And so it's talking about essentially this question, which is how can we practice RJ without acknowledging the first harm of this nation, which is the theft of Indigenous land. The way in which no one is disposable pauses me and takes my breath away. That question pauses me wanting. I think that's where I feel very fueled in this moment. This work needs to continue to be fueled and fed as we need to feed each other. Any final affirmations, anything from you as we close up?
No, I think, thank you so much for having me on the podcast, and thank you for everything you shared with me and the wisdom I inherited at Markham Summer Camp. There were still counselors leading circles the way that you had taught them to lead circles. And so you were still, your wisdom was still alive and well there. And so much of what I've learned about being restorative, I've learned from you and your team. And every time we talk, I'm scribbling down notes because I say, I want to sound like they sound. I want to sound like Gilbert sounds. Just amazingly eloquent and compassionate. And just with such a deep knowledge to share. And so, again, I enjoyed all the opportunities that I've had to collaborate with you, to learn from you, and excited about the future work that we're going to do together. So thank you so much to you and to your whole team at CCJ.
Thank you, Tobin. Thank you. And so with that, I want to thank the boys of Cabin 5 who came from North Charleston, who at McLennanville YMCA camp taught me about how to sit in a circle on the floor in pajamas and pillows and talk about the day. But I this work always pushes me. And so I have to acknowledge the bending that this work calls us to do, because had it not been for, and this work also teaches me much about gratitude. So I never thought I would give gratitude to this being, but I suppose I have to give gratitude to the Lizard Man, because had it not been for the unrestorative approach of the camp director using the Lizard Man as a fear tactic for discipline, I would not have been called to ask the question about why they didn't want to go to sleep. But that would not have happened unless I would have asked about how their day was. Thank you, Utopin. Thank you to all the folks at Green Dot who are doing amazing and strong work. And Green Dot has been a district that has really pushed me, challenged me, where I've grown in a really beautiful way in this work too. So I'm super grateful for all of the schools and the sites and the staff and the students and the young people who have built this work and helped shape it along with us at CCJ. And so with that, you've been listening to What You Know About RJ, sharing stories and skills about restorative justice. Please remember to like and subscribe. Thank you.